Welcome, everyone, to the Glenel TELUS seminar called Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About System 3 Products But Were Afraid to Ask. Today, I'm going to be interviewing Kern Hendricks, who's the owner of System 3 Resins. And my name is Gail Brantek. I'm the Vice President of Glenel Marine Designs. And my father, Glenn, started Glenel back in 1953 when he saw the need for boat plans for the regular do-it-yourself person who could benefit from way more details and instructions than the typical professional set of plans offered. Thus, Glenel Marine Designs was born, and ever since we've provided plans, kits, and supplies to build your own boat. We have about 300 different designs from 6-foot to 55-foot that you can build in wood, fiberglass, steel, and aluminum construction. Now, for about 30 years or so, we've had our own line of epoxy that we offer through our online store. And a few years back, we added System 3 products and have had great feedback from those of you who use them. So during our discussion this afternoon, if you have a question, by the way, you can enter it on the screen that has the call-in number, and that's on that webcast screen. There's a little box there for you to type your questions in. And if we have time, we'll get to them. I know that many of you emailed questions ahead of time, and we'll try to get to all of those, too. If you aren't near a computer, you can always email your questions later, and I can get back to you. Now, if you are on that event page, you'll see that there's a link there to order System 3 Trial Kit, and I hope you'll take advantage of that. This kit's only $29 plus postage, and you'll get a coupon for $20 off your first order. So it really only costs you $9 and postage to try out their products, so I highly recommend that you do that. Anyway, I thought it would be helpful for us to talk directly, hear directly from System 3 about their products, and Kern was kind enough to offer to do that for us, and we're real happy to have him on the line with us. So thanks so much, Kern, for taking time out to do this, and how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Gail. We had a little rain here in Seattle after about 2 months of drought and a lot of heat, and it's a pretty day out today. It's partially cloudy.
Well, send some of that rain down to California.
It's on its way.
Oh, please. I hope so. So, Kern, I have a really quick little story to tell about you because, you know, when I was putting all this information together for the teleseminar, I realized that I didn't know what your title was. And so I called up System 3 and talked to Leah, who she's a great person. We talk to her all the time. And I said, Leah, what's Kern Hendricks' title? And she paused for a minute and she said, I don't really know if he has a title. She said, he's the owner of our company. I said, he's the owner? Well, nobody told me that. And, you know, I've been on your website, and it doesn't really say anything about you that I could find. And so I'm just privileged that you've taken your time to be with us today. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your background?
I will do that. I decided many years ago to build a 14-foot catamaran out of plywood, and I used the only epoxy that was on the market at that time, and built the boat, and I have a degree in chemical engineering, and I got very intrigued by epoxy resin, so I decided to develop an epoxy resin, which I did over the next year or so, and that became what is today our general purpose epoxy resin with hardeners number 1, 2, and 3.
Okay.
And in 1979, Tom Freeman and I, Tom was of Jim Brown fame. Tom was running the Sea Runner trimaran plan sale, and I was very interested in building a Sea Runner. And I met Tom that way, so I did build a Sea Runner 34-foot trimaran.
Okay.
And that was the first boat built with System 3 epoxy. And Tom and I started the company officially in 1979, 30 years ago, and started marketing epoxy. We were in the Bay Area in California at the time and moved up to the business up to Seattle about 5 years later, and we've been in the Seattle area since.
Okay.
And we've got a number of epoxy products today. One of the things that's always intrigued me with my degree is exploring the technology and developing new products, and I think that is kind of one thing that makes us different from a lot of the other boat epoxy companies out there. We're always innovating and pushing the envelope and pushing the limits.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very good. So there you go. That my next question was, what makes your products? Well, what does make your products? And what would you say makes them superior to other resins? And I know ours is included in that, too, and that's fine.
Well, I don't like the word superior. I like the word different, because superior implies that you're measuring it relative to something, and, you know, as one man's meat is another man's poison.
Sure.
I think what makes them different is the technology that goes into them. We made a right-hand turn in the mid-90s. We were almost exclusively into boat building epoxies at that time, and we decided that we had something to offer in non-marine areas. So I think the first area we offered a non-marine product was to a company here in Washington State that makes windmill blades that are used for frost protection in vineyards and orchards and things, and we developed an epoxy resin for them. That was almost 15 years ago, and they're still a customer today.
Mm-hmm.
We were the supplier of epoxy resins for the Sonicare toothbrush.
Oh.
And anybody who's got a Sonicare picks up our product every day without knowing it.
Wow.
And that business, unfortunately, is, like so many, is all moved to the Asia.
Wow.
And when we took that turn, we were still supplying the marine epoxies, but we were really learning about epoxy resin technology and formulating epoxy resins, because the non-marine area is significantly different in one respect than the marine area. Characterize epoxies in the marine area as the chemistry set approach. One buys a resin, one buys a hardener, and maybe pumps and things like that, and then powdered fillers. So if one wants an adhesive, they might mix the resin and hardener and then silica thickener, colloidal silica, whatever you want to call it, Cabasil, Aerosil, it's all basically the same thing, and that's a thixotropic agent. It turns the epoxy from being a liquid into a paste.
Mm-hmm.
So you now have a gap-filling glue. That we call the chemistry set approach, and you can do microballoons in that mix, and wood fiber and wood flour and all of these other things.
Mm-hmm.
When you're out of the marine sphere of epoxies, if you walked in with a chemistry set approach, let's say for the Sonicare toothbrush, and told them all I have to do is buy the resin and the hardener and this product and that and stir it in and stir the powders in, they'd laugh you out of their offices.
Right.
They're just not going to do that. And that doesn't matter whether it's that end use or it's the windmill blade guys or it's other electrical potting uses or other epoxy uses, you've got to take in a product that essentially is a part A and a part B, so that all the user has to do is mix them and they're ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
That engendered the Silvertip line of products. And we started to bring that technology back into the marine industry when we started to develop the Silvertip product line 10 years ago.
Okay.
And what we were trying to do there is get fillers, the powdered obnoxious fillers, out of the user's hands.
Okay.
We wanted to do that for several reasons, Gail. One was that they're messy.
Mm-hmm.
Two is they require a lot of technical support. People would say, well, how much do I add? How much do I add? And the answer is, add as much as you like to suit the purpose you're using it for. And,
right.
And that doesn't always work with somebody who's building their first boat.
Sure.
And that was our goal, to get the fillers out of the user's hands. And then we realized the moment we do that, we can abandon the chemistry set approach. We no longer need one resin for multiple applications. We can tailor make the resin system for specific applications. And epoxy adhesives, for instance, are very different than epoxy coating resins. And good epoxy adhesives will glue aluminum, steel, brass, copper, and other materials. Coating epoxy resin, such as our general purpose epoxy or West System epoxy, typically won't glue things like aluminum, steel, and other hard to glue things. They'll glue porous things just fine, but they don't glue the tough things. And so we started to tailor make the epoxy resin, the liquid portion of the system, to suit the specific end use.
Okay. All right. Well, specifically, you mentioned the general purpose and the silver tip. What's the difference benefit between the two?
Well, the difference is that the general purpose was the original one, and it relies entirely on the chemistry set approach. And the silver tip product series are all formulated so that the user only has to measure and mix the part A and the part B. If fillers are present in the formulation, it's because we put them in here in the factory where we have the proper equipment to do it, and we can do something that you just simply cannot do when you take the chemistry set approach, and it's this. When you put microballoons or you put cabasil or silica thickener in an epoxy, you put an enormous amount of air in with it. And when we do that in the factory, we do it under vacuum. So we pull the air back out. And that gives us much better flow characteristics. And one of the products that really benefits from that is one of the silver tip products, and one of the fastest growing of them is the Quick Fair, which is a very fast curing fairing compound. It's sandable in about 3 hours after application. And that boatyards love that because they can get an application, three applications on in a day with sanding in between. And you just can't do that with any of the chemistry set epoxies. Whether they're ours or yours or Goujon Brothers West System or whatever. They're all compromises.
Now, I know the silver tip resin used for laminating, that one is also has no blush, right?
So that, no blush.
And that's better for those who are looking for a natural finish?
The problem with blush, and it's technically it's called amine blush, it's a reaction of the epoxy hardeners curing in the presence of moist carbon dioxide. I mean, there's always carbon dioxide in the air. That's what global warming is all about. But when it's moist and the temperatures are down, the amines in the curing agent of the epoxy will react with that moist carbon dioxide to form what is commonly known as amine blush. And it's characterized as kind of a greasy feel on the surface. Sometimes you can wipe your fingers on it, and you can see the traces of where you wiped your finger, and that's amine blush. It's not detrimental to the clarity of the epoxy, but it should be removed before you put an additional coat on, so it adds another step to the process. Furthermore, because it is kind of wet and moist, it can attract dust and other contaminants, which can louse up a clear coating.
Do the epoxies, the general purpose silver tip, do they yellow?
Gail, all epoxies are going to yellow slowly over a period of time, whether they're ours or anybody else's. And the yellowing isn't the same as UV degradation. UV degradation will push the yellowing faster, but the yellowing is not the end result from UV degradation. You can cast a disc of epoxy resin and totally put it in a dark room for 6 months, and it will have yellowed, even though there's no light there. And that's a function of just simply the molecular structure of the cured epoxy.
Okay.
UV degradation is usually present or is noticed. The surface will start to become dull and then hazy and finally more or less opaque and then brittle and flaky and so on at a loose strength.
Mm-hmm.
One of the common questions we get about UV degradation, I think people get confused by it. They confuse, you know, going out in the California sun on a hot July day at 2 in the afternoon without the sunscreen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can get a burn in an hour out there.
Right.
It isn't going to affect the epoxy in an hour. Usually, to see UV degradation, it would probably take four to six months of exposure of a panel, a wooden panel coated with epoxy left in the Mojave Desert.
Okay.
It isn't like walking out to your car and spending 10 minutes with your boat exposed to the sun.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's say, to get specific, let's say we have a lot of guys out there that are building, you know, really nice-looking mahogany runabouts with
mm-hmm.
the nice decks on them and everything. What do you recommend? Which products, and not just for coating or fiberglassing, but just for building a boat like that, which would be cold-molded?
Well, I would. I'm a real fan of the Silvertip products. If I had to say that they had one drawback at all, it's that they are what they are. You can thicken gel magic, but you're going to add some cabasil to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to do that, then why not just do the general purpose approach and go back to the chemistry set, and then you've got the entire range. But I think we've made the Silvertip products so that they'll work for 99% of all boat building applications, and you may have somebody that needs to modify it a little bit. But
mm-hmm.
I would, for cold molding, my choice would be is the adhesive would be Gel Magic, Silvertip Gel Magic with slow hardener. And Gel Magic is reason we call it that, Gail, is that it does two very kind of neat things. One is the resin has got blue dye in it.
Okay.
And as soon as that resin starts getting mixed with the hardener, the dye goes away. The hardener kills the dye. So that tells you when you got it mixed.
Oh, okay.
The second thing about it is that as you mix it, it starts to body up
mm-hmm.
and becomes a soft gel. It goes from being a pourable liquid to a soft gel.
Okay.
And that soft gel gives you the gap-filling properties.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we came up with the name Gel Magic. That's what I would use for almost all wood gluing operations, cold molding or what have you.
Okay.
And then going on from there, if you're going to bright finish the boat,
mm-hmm.
You're not going to want to use any fairing compound because those are opaque and they're going to stand out like a sore thumb.
Okay.
You've got to be very careful to keep that surface clean and undented and so on. And then you fiberglass it with Silvertip laminating resin, either the fast or the slow hardener, depending on the temperature where you're doing it. If it's above 80 degrees, I'd go with the slow. If it's below that, I'd probably go with the fast.
Okay. 80 degrees. Okay. Well, another, you also have, and I don't know if I'm bouncing back too much, but you also have, I was reading about your clear coat.
Right.
Clear coat is
a very thin, brushable, 100% solid solvent-free epoxy resin system.
Okay.
And it is an excellent product for epoxy coating bright work before varnishing.
Okay.
One can put on, and you could do a mahogany deck on a runabout. You generally, a little runabout or something, I'm not sure I'd necessarily put fiberglass on a mahogany deck of that.
Right.
Unless it was going to be walked on or something extensively, because I don't think you need the extra abrasion resistance you get from fiberglass. I'd probably use clear coat epoxy, several coats of that, and then sand it and put on a good varnish. We have one. There's a number of them. Z-Spar's got some good varnishes.
You know, we can't use Z-Spar in California anymore.
Oh, really? Because of the VOCs?
Yep.
Yeah, well, I think we're okay on the VOCs.
Okay.
We also have a water-reducible clear polyurethane material that's excellent. It's a little trickier to use than varnishing, but it's got just incredible abrasion resistance being a polyurethane, so that's okay in California.
Yeah.
I think our own spar varnish is okay in California. I'm not.
Yeah.
And then another good varnish is Interlux Clipper Clear.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think all builders have to recognize that when you use a paint or a varnish on an epoxy resin, you're kind of creating a system that may be unique. It won't be unique if it's, say, Z-Spar on epoxy resin, because that's done all the time. But we commonly get questions from, say, somebody in Minneapolis, and there's some local paint company up there that makes a paint he wants to use.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, can I use such and such paint over your epoxy resin? And there's just no way that we're going to be able to give a good answer to that, because we may not have ever heard of the paint, but even if it's a common paint, that we're probably not going to test it, because we're kind of between a rock and a hard place. If we say you can, and based on our testing, and then the manufacturer of the paint changes the formulation, it may no longer work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a publication called the Epoxy Book, and it has a whole section on painting, and we recommend that people, regardless of what they're doing, do a test patch.
Okay.
Make sure here's what you're looking for. The first thing, you know, a test patch can be a 2-inch square.
Okay.
You just brush it on the prepared epoxy surface. What you're looking for is what is known as through drying. That is, does it not only dry on the surface, but does it dry all the way through? And the way you check for that is you can scratch the coating the next day with your fingernail, and if it's on there firmly, it through dried. If it accordions up and is sticky underneath, it's not through dried yet. It may do that in another day, or it may not. Some one-part oil-based paints and varnishes don't cure properly on epoxy resins.
Okay.
That's the first thing we look for. If it does that, then the next thing we look for is adhesion. And the Epoxy Book covers, that's available on our website, and I think you may send those out too.
Yeah.
But you want to do what is known as the crosshatch adhesion test, and that's a real simple test. You can take a utility knife and just cut about an 8-line tic-tac-toe pattern with the lines about an eighth of an inch apart, and then press down some masking tape or 2-inch-wide Scotch packaging tape or something on it with your thumb, and then jerk-pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a bunch of little squares coming off, you have poor adhesion.
Sure, okay.
And the coating, if you have poor adhesion, eventually the coating is going to fail. It'll blister, it'll peel or something,
okay.
Especially in water. I mean, it's going to fail. And
mm-hmm.
on the other hand, if it if you don't get any little squares off, maybe you might get a little corner of one where you cut it. But if you don't, essentially don't get any squares off, that coating is not going to fail. It's not going to delaminate.
Okay.
So any builder should do that.
Okay.
I joke that, hey, you can do a 2-inch square test, or you can test the whole boat, but either way, you're going to do a test.
That's right.
And it's much easier to recover from the 2-inch square test.
Yeah, good point. Well, we sell our plans all over the world, and we have guys that are in freezing climates, and I know that it takes some heat for the epoxy to cure. So what do you recommend for folks in cold weather states?
Almost all of our products, when used with the fast hardener, will cure fine at temperatures 50 degrees and up. They'll take more time. The rule of thumb is if you lower the temperature 18 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 10 degrees Celsius, the cure time will take be twice as long. Contrary, if you raise it 10, it'll be half as long.
Okay.
And when you get down below 50 degrees, it just starts to get a little slow, and you can kind of have side reactions, especially if it's a coating or something like that. And what I recommend people do is heat the area with the curing epoxy locally. I mean, just building a small boat, maybe in a garage or something like that, maybe as simple as going and getting a 12 by 20 foot plastic tarp from $8 or $10 from Lowe's or Home Depot, and stretching a rope over the boat and making a little tent and putting 200 or 300 watt light bulbs in there and raising the temperature. Maybe you raise the temperature from 45 to 58.
Right.
And that doesn't seem like a lot. You wouldn't want to spend an evening in there, but to the epoxy, that's tremendous. I mean, you will cut the cure time way down by just doing something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I remember my dad doing that way back with polyester. Right.
Same thing.
Okay.
Keep the temperature and keep it up locally. If you're gluing little pieces together, maybe you're making some small piece on a sub-assembly on a boat, put it in a big cardboard box with a light bulb.
Sure. Okay.
You get the temperature up in there to 80, 90 degrees. That's just roasty toasty.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, very good. Well, I know that we also recommend that people store their epoxy. Seems common sense, but just store their epoxy inside where it's warmer and not in the cold.
Right, absolutely. That'll make a huge difference from two standpoints. One is that you're just starting with warmer epoxy. It's going to react faster, but just as importantly as that, it'll have much lower viscosity and mix better.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Contrary-wise, in the summer, people have the opposite problem.
Okay, right.
The epoxy is curing so fast, they can't use it. Well, what we often find is some guy is, maybe he's got a little boat building shop away from his home, and he's going there after work, and he's got the jugs of epoxy resin sitting inside of his car with the windows up and the doors locked all day long, and the temperature inside the car is 125 degrees, and the epoxy gets pretty warm, and it goes so fast because you're mixing hot epoxy.
Right.
Get the epoxy cooled. So in the winter, you might want to keep the epoxy indoors, which is no problem at all. You don't get any odors out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the summer, keep it cool. Even if your only source of cool is a bag of ice and a 5-gallon bucket, put some water and some ice in there and cool the epoxy down.
Yeah.
And there are other strategies beyond that. Obviously, one it would be to not mix any more than you're going to be able to apply in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is once it's mixed in a larger, deep container, get it out in a shallow container.
Mm-hmm.
And we've even had people take that shallow container and put it in a paint tray. A paint roller tray is a great one for that.
Yeah.
We've had people take like a paint roller tray and place it on a towel with a bunch of ice cubes in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you can, and they're out there using the epoxy when it's 105 degrees out. You can do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, we've done it here. Okay. Well, you also, I read an article online that you wrote about the clamping pressure, because I know that can be an issue with epoxy since it does have the gap filling properties.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that too?
For strength, it isn't necessary to really clamp an epoxy glue joint at all. I mean, contact pressure works just fine.
Okay.
You could glue two flat pieces of small flat pieces of plywood together, and all you'd need is, say, a 6-inch square, for the sake of argument. Four rubber bands will give you enough pressure to hold that piece in shape,
mm-hmm.
or in place until the epoxy cures. Clamping pressure becomes a problem when you're applying too much clamping pressure, and the reason is this: that mechanically you squeeze most of the epoxy out of the joint,
right.
And then the wood absorbs what is left during the curing process, and you end up with a starved joint.
Right.
I mean, it's as simple as that. So we don't recommend much more than contact pressure. If you use C-clamps, don't sit there and honk down on them.
Mm-hmm.
Close the joint. You should reach a position where the joint is closed. And you'll see the squeeze out, and if you tighten the clamp down anymore, you'd get more squeeze out, but you don't want to go that far.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and obviously there are places you have to clamp, so that's good.
Sure.
We don't want guys to have failing joints on their boat.
No.
That would be pretty awful.
No, and once in a while, I mean, despite all the precautions, you're laminating a tiller or something for a small sailboat, and you overclamped it, and you find when you cut it to clean it up, one of the lams kind of opened up a little bit, and that's not the end of the world. All you really have to do is mix up a little epoxy and squeeze it in there with a syringe and close it back up and let it cure. You've recovered.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Well, speaking of syringe, you guys have that Utah cartridge. That's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, that is. Just for those that are listening, one of the slickest ways to apply two-part epoxies, especially adhesives, or with a caulking gun in a cartridge with a static mixer. A static mixer is nothing more than a plastic tube that has a bunch of baffles in it, which in effect keeps shuffling a deck of cards, to use an analogy, the stream of epoxy resin and hardener going through that constantly gets mixed and shuffled.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years they've been side-by-side cartridges, and they've been used extensively in industrial applications. The problem with side-by-side cartridges is they take a gun with two plungers to push the piston into the cartridge, and those guns are not commonly available, and they aren't cheap. You can find them. You have to mail order them. They're probably $50, $60 each, and if one breaks or lose it, you're kind of SOL.
Mm-hmm.
Till you got a replacement. Well, along came one of the companies, a company called TAH out of New Jersey, very clever guy, founded the company, and he reasoned that if he could come up with a tandem cartridge the same size as a regular 10-ounce caulking tube, he'd solve the problem of the availability of guns, because any decent store has got caulking guns.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And they named this the Utah cartridge, and we package three products in that today. All adhesives. We package Gel Magic, mm-hmm. both fast and slow. T88, which is kind of a one-to-one overnight cure epoxy. It's used quite a bit by builders of wooden aircraft.
Okay.
And then finally our quick cure, our five-minute epoxy. And the nice thing about those cartridges, Gail, they can be used with a static mixer. And if you're going to do a lot of gluing at once, the static mixer, it's just like staying in a really nice hotel.
Okay.
And on the other hand, if you're going to use it just a little bit now and maybe in an hour a little bit more, you don't want to keep wasting static mixers, because the epoxy does set up in the static mixer.
Uh-huh.
And the trick is to keep fresh material pumping through.
Okay.
Well, you can simply not use the static mixer and use the cartridge and dispense without the static mixer at exactly the correct ratio into a little cup or something and hand mix it.
Okay.
And so in that case, the cartridge simply serves as a ratioing package.
Mm-hmm.
You never have to worry about losing one bottle and finding the other, because they're always together.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very handy product, definitely. Okay. Well, you have paint, and I love that you have it, because it's water-based and we can ship it. We used to sell Interlex, and
right.
Because of the hazmat fees and shipping standards and requirements, we just weren't able to ship it anymore. So, and anyway, we've had some good feedback on your paint product. So, what can you tell us about?
Well, we defensively, in about 1992, decided we had to develop a line of paints that were compatible over epoxy resins.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to the late 80s or the early 90s, there was no problem with putting any oil-based paints over epoxy resin. And the reason that it became a problem was, is the EPA forced the paint makers to remove certain metallic dryers from paints.
Okay.
And these were all oil, one part oil-based paints have dryers in them. And these dryers are essentially catalysts that help the linseed oil and other materials in the paint oxidize or polymerize.
Okay.
And so the paint companies didn't bother to tell the epoxy companies that this change was made.
Oh, no.
And all of a sudden, these guys were painting big boats. And I remember one as big as 40 feet. The guy sprayed it, and the paint never dried.
Oh, my gosh.
And what a nightmare. And your heart just breaks for a guy like that. We didn't know anything about it, but we rapidly determined what the cause was. And we decided that the only way we could ever assure somebody they could use a paint over our epoxy was if we made the paint, if we controlled the paint.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to develop our own line of paints. And as I pointed out, it was kind of a defensive move at first. And at that time, there was technology had been developed over water-based polyurethane dispersions. And we started to play around with them and learn how to pigment them, which is what we needed to do to make a colored paint.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it went from there. I think we first offered those to the home-built aircraft industry, and then we did a deal with a paint supplier to that and helped him develop a line and kind of gotten out of that. And then we were selling them to boat builders, and we've been doing that now for about 16 years, and the products have evolved
mm-hmm.
over that period of time. They're great products from a wear standpoint, from a UV standpoint. They're tough. We've used variations off of our marine paints to make both paints for fishing rods as well as for a long time all of the new Abercrombie and Fitch Hollister stores used our paints and one of our epoxies on the floor to make give it kind of the warehouse look. I mean, these things really wear. Nothing wears better than these in the tests that the Abercrombie folks did.
Wow.
And so we keep working on these paints as technology becomes available and they become easier to apply. There's one little thing that your customer should know about that you can't, unfortunately, you can't get a high gloss from this technology if the paint has been pigmented. We can get a nice glossy semi-gloss, which I think for a lot of boats is plenty good.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want that real high wet look gloss, you've got to overcoat it with our clear LPU.
Okay.
And we call those all of that whole product line WR for water reducible dash LPU for linear polyurethane.
Okay.
And they hold up as well as a solvent based one. They're very tough. They don't crack. Great abrasion resistance. They're very strong. They have one little idiosyncrasy, and we caution users in our literature is if you apply them and you've got a masked area, you have to remove the masking tape before the paint film sets, or you have to score the edge of the masking tape where the paint line is. Otherwise, you can start to peel the paint. This paint is peculiar in the sense that it develops tensile strength a lot quicker than it develops peel strength. It takes almost 4 or 5 days to maximize on peel strength.
Okay.
And so we caution people to be careful of that. And if you do start to peel it, don't keep pulling on it.
Okay.
It's, you know, don't start scab picking on us here.
Yeah.
And the great paints, once you get them on, a little bit of a learning curve, you learn how to do it, and they're just bulletproof when they're done.
Okay. And tell me again what you put on it to get a really high gloss finish.
Well, you just put on we have a clear version of it, the WRLPU clear top coat.
Okay. Clear top coat. Okay. All right. Well, okay, say you are peeling. When you said when you're peeling off the tape and it starts to peel off, then you just stop. But then
you just stop and go back and score the tape and make sure you don't peel it, and then you're going to just have to repair that area a little bit later, which
okay.
is not a big deal.
Okay. Well, I do notice that you don't have a bottom paint below the waterline.
No.
Is there anything you recommend for that? Or
We recommend that people just consult marine stores and the like in the area they're going to use the boat. If they're in salt water, talk to the people who have boats in the area. Find out what people like. Some bottom paints work extremely well in brackish waters. Others don't. The turbidity of the water can matter, and we know these things, but we're not experts on saying, okay, if you got this condition, here's what you should use.
Mm-hmm.
Just talk to local people.
Okay.
And obviously, if you're using a trailer boat, you don't even have to bother with it, even in salt water. I mean, you can have a regular boat in salt water for 3 or 4 days, and you're not going to collect enough growth that a sponge will take that much growth off. So.
Okay. All right. Well, anything? Is there anything else that I haven't asked that you might want to add?
Well, you sent me an email here with some questions you'd received. Let me look at these things. Here's one. One of the problems with common to epoxies is that they will they can, if stored at temperatures below about 65 to 70 degrees, start to solidify.
Okay.
Just the resin side, not the hardener. And this is because pure epoxy resin would rather be a solid at room temperature than a liquid.
Okay.
And so epoxy resins, depending on what the formula is, are really kind of super cool liquids. That is, they're liquids that they're materials that exist in the liquid state below their freezing point. And if you get anything in there, a very common thing to get in there, you've got a bottle you've poured out of, or you've pumped out of, and air has got to displace the removed epoxy, and the air might have a little bit of fine sawdust in it or something. All of that fine sawdust can serve as sites for crystals to form. It's just like cloud formation in the atmosphere.
Okay.
Water droplets form on dust, and then it crystallizes. Mm-hmm. And one of the most common technical questions we get is, my epoxy is crystallized. The bottom is all white and solid. Incidentally, water is about the only thing in the world that when it crystallizes, the solid part goes to the top, and that's called ice,
right?
Like ice on a pond. Mm-hmm. Everything else in the world, it goes to the bottom.
Oh, okay.
So you'll find the white crystal epoxy on the bottom.
Okay.
And simply taking that bottle at that point, let's say it's been sitting on your garage floor, which is a giant heat sink,
mm-hmm.
not the place to store it. But if it's been sitting there throughout the winter, chances are you're going to have epoxy crystals on the bottom. Well, it's not enough to wait for the first warm day and have that bounce back to the liquid state. You've got to heat that up to about 120 to 25 degrees in that range and bring the material back to the point where it's not only are there no white solid crystals in it anymore, but it's also bright.
Okay.
And by bright, I mean it's not hazy, that you don't have little hazy crystals in it that make it hazy, because if you do that, then you've got those crystals can allow more epoxy to crystallize on them, and you'll go right back to where you were.
Okay.
So you got to come back to a clear and bright state. And you had one fellow ask that, and if I can just read here, he says, I can redissolve the solids with heating, but it seems that each time I reheat the resin to dissolve the solids, it becomes more difficult to get the clear liquid. You gotta get up to the point where you pass that haziness.
Okay.
Now, people ask, hey, I got crystals on the bottom. Can I use the material on the top, which is not crystallized? And the answer is yes, if you're in a hurry, because as far as we can tell, it's exactly the same as the crystallized material, but we still recommend that when you got the time, get rid of the crystallization.
Mm-hmm.
And then store the bottles inside 70 degrees or above.
Okay. All right.
So that was a question. Another one was somebody asked, how can you tell visually when an epoxy is old and should be removed from the shelf and replaced with fresh epoxy? Well, in our experience, epoxy doesn't get old.
Yeah, same here. Yeah.
If it's if you've kept the cap on it and you don't have water in it or other crap in it, it'll be good 10 years down the road. We've actually found retained samples that are 20 years old and they work just fine. The hardener is dark. I mean, it's not pretty, but they work because the hardeners will darken over time, but they cure just fine.
Yeah. And we always recommend, we've never found that it's not good after any particular
right.
either, but we always test it first just to make sure.
Right. That's what I say. If you've got some that's been around for a long time, do a little test.
Right.
Mix a little up. Make sure you mix it accurate. If it cures hard, it's fine. I've never seen it not cure hard.
Yeah.
Here's another good one that we might touch on. Somebody said, how do you keep spar urethane from running when applying it to the sides of a boat? Well, he's talking about our paint, but I think this is true of all of them. One of the things that paint manufacturers have been forced to do because of VOC requirements is cut back the amount of solvents in their varnishes.
Mm-hmm.
And the net effect of this is that you as the user brush on a coat that's too thick. And the coat sits there for a while, and then it starts to sag.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you get rid of runs, and we can't put this on the can, and I'll deny that I ever said this,
okay,
is just take the same mineral spirits that you use to clean the brushes when you're done,
mm-hmm,
and add a little bit of it to the paint.
Okay.
You know, 7-8%. The reason we can't say it on the can is that then we'd have to count it in calculating the VOCs.
Oh, okay.
So there you go. And you can buy mineral spirits or ordinary paint thinner. I mean, that you can buy that legally. You can buy the varnish, and there's no law against you adding a little bit of the two together, but we just can't say it.
Okay.
If you thin it 8, 9, 10% or so, you can brush out a thinner coat.
Mm-hmm.
The mineral spirits will evaporate, and then you've got the, you know, you've got the higher bodied coat on there in a thinner film.
Okay.
And it won't run and sag, and then it'll also flow and level better.
Wow. Good to know.
So whenever anybody's having any problems with getting flow and leveling on our varnish, we say, hey, come on, you know, splash a little of the cleanup solvent in the,
yeah, okay,
in,
yeah,
the can.
Very good.
Let's see, what else have we got here, Gail?
Well, this Grant also asked, is the general purpose epoxy strong enough to make a Glenelg design without the use of fasteners?
Sure. I built a 34-foot sailboat, and the only fasteners I ever used were staples.
Okay.
And that was just to hold things in place until the epoxy dried.
Yeah.
Epoxy is going to be stronger than any softwood, and it's stronger than most hardwoods.
Yeah. I had a feeling you'd say that. My father would argue with you about that, just because he tends to be on the conservative side. And would prefer to have, and also, I'm sure, because he was building boats long before there were epoxies.
Right.
But
well, I would probably agree with your father in some cases. And here's the case: I think you need a fastener. If there are really three types of failures, there's tensile. Well, there's four: tensile, compression, shear, which is the sliding, you know, one surface over another. And then there's the most insidious one of all, and that's a peel, P-E-E-L, like you're peeling something. And anybody who's ever had a can of beer knows it's real easy to tear the aluminum,
mm-hmm,
whereas it's not very easy to pull the aluminum apart. And the reason is you're concentrating all of the force right there at the line of separation. And so if you have something glued on a boat where the force is going to tend to peel it,
mm-hmm,
or open it up, then using a fastener makes all the sense in the world, because the fastener makes it so that the opening force or the peeling force has to break that fastener in tension before it can open up the joint.
Okay.
And in that case, I think you need a fastener.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But if you don't have those kind of forces, then I don't think fasteners are. The epoxy is great in tension, shear, compression. And if those are the only forces on it, fasteners are redundant after it's cured.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we've got a question about bottom paint. We already answered that. And then Carl Kessler asked, I've used West System several times. How's your product different, better, or compared to West?
West System's a good product. There's nothing wrong with West System. It goes back to the chemistry set approach. I think it even goes back in a way further than that. The Goujons were building ice boats indoors in Michigan in the winter, where the humidity, because you're heating, you know, fairly cold air, the humidity is really low after you've heated it. Their epoxy, they didn't have to worry too much about what the humidity was outside when they were using them and so on. We developed our initial general purpose resin in the San Francisco Bay Area, where the humidity, especially in the colder months, was always high. Mm-hmm. And we developed a product that had to be able to be used in, more real world conditions.
Okay.
And I think that's probably the most significant difference. And then we decided, since we were starting from scratch, that a 2-to-1 mixture was much easier to use than a 5-to-1. I mean, a 1-to-1 would have been perfect, because nobody has to remember which part is the one and which part is the other one.
Right.
But we just found that we couldn't get the physical properties we wanted for a coating resin from a 1-to-1 system.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to 2-to-1, because after all, the chemistry set approach, what you're really building is a coating resin that you modify with the fillers to make an adhesive and so on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I'm not going to pick on anybody's product. We do what we do. We do it very well. I think we've got some technology that nobody else has. I don't know whether it's because they don't know how to develop it or don't think it's important, but it's there and it works for us.
Yeah, okay. Well, Tom in New Jersey said, when you are fiberglassing the bottom and sides of a boat, the sides are almost vertical. Are there any tricks to preventing the finished coats of epoxy from sagging and dripping down the side?
Well, yes, there are. Don't put it on too thickly. That's the number one trick. So how can you affect that? Well, one is you can make sure that your resin and hardener, when you start, are as warm as feasible. If they're real cold, you're going to put a thick coat on, because you just can't spread mechanically the coat thin enough.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind if somebody, if you're talking about filling the weave of glass cloth,
mm-hmm.
and you've got a problem, you know, put in about 6 or 7% lacquer thinner.
Okay.
After you've mixed the resin and hardener, and then that'll be much thinner, or you can use a product like our clear coat epoxy to fill the weave. The trick is you've got to put on a thin coat. If you don't put on a thin coat, you're going to get sags and runs.
Okay.
And if it's 6-ounce cloth on the side of the boat, it's probably going to take 3 thin coats.
Mm-hmm.
But the nice thing is with all of our products, you can put a second coat on within 72 hours without sanding.
Okay.
So you just put on a coat in the morning. If it's set in the late afternoon, put another coat on, and then put another coat on the next morning, and you got it.
Yeah. Okay. And Joseph in Ohio wanted to know, what's the relationship between an epoxy coating and the structural integrity of the finished project?
It can be significant or insignificant, and I'm not trying to dodge the question. Wood is a particularly strong material.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're putting an epoxy fiberglass coating on a 1/2-inch plywood, you're not going to really change the overall strength that much. On the other hand, if you're putting the same 6-ounce cloth on a 3-millimeter Brunzeel plywood veneer, it'll have a significant effect. If you understand what I'm saying, I mean, it's an epoxy glass fiberglass is about 12 to 15 thousandths of an inch thick. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to have much effect on half inch and overall strength, but it would on something that's down 2 to 3 millimeters.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's the real effect.
Well, Kenneth in Missouri asks if custom color mixing is offered for your top coats.
We do that. We charge for it. The number escapes me. I'm going to just say something that's within the ballpark. Anybody who wants to know can either get a hold of you and you can give them the answer. They can call us.
Okay.
I think it's about $40 a gallon plus the gallon price.
Okay.
And we need about the bigger the patch we have to match, the better. If it's less than about 2 inches by 2 inches, it becomes really problematic of whether we can match it. We can't do metallics. Metallics have aluminum in them, and that's why they look metallic. We can't do that in water-based things. They'll react. But we can do a pretty good job on straight color matches, and it's reproducible. So if somebody needs a gallon down the line, they can come back and we can give them something that they could put right next to what they put on before, and it won't show.
Okay. Well, I think that pretty much takes up our time for the day. So.
Well, good. Well, I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, same here. I feel like I've learned a lot and have a new appreciation for System 3 products, and I hope the guys out there have picked up some tips and stuff too. So thank you, Kern.
Okay,
so
Gail.
For your time, and
have a nice evening.
You too. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.